America 2 Hewitt, joined now by AEI's Michael Rubin. The Iranian elections are this week. Mr. Rubin is one of the experts on the Islamic Republic of Iran. Michael, welcome back. What are you seeing happening, unfolding in Iran right now, and what's the significance of it?
Well, there's one thing that's certain, and it's the only thing that's certain when it comes to the Iranian elections. The winner is going to be Supreme Leader Khamenei, because we've got to remember, even though they have elections among different candidates for president, ultimately, number one, the president doesn't really matter in the Iranian system. It's a position more of style than of substance. And number two, the supreme leader only allows those to run who pretty much agree with his vision. It would be like if in the old Soviet Union, you had four different Brezhnevs running for election.
Now, in terms of, there's been some analysis that, Mousavi's got all these big crowds are not being broken up. This means the mullahs are shifting to him and Ahmadinejad is losing his power. That's just all noise, Michael Rubin?
Actually, I have to say I do believe it is. There have certainly been a lot of rallies, but Ahmadinejad has had mass rallies as well. And in the past, there's been rallies. I have a feeling it's a little bit more of advocacy rather than analysis. People in the United States wanting Mousavi, a former prime minister, to run. But one of the things that's quite interesting is that during the first televised debate between Ahmadinejad and Mousavi, and this is the first election where they've had televised debates, believe it or not, Ahmadinejad pretty much cleared up the slate with him. More than 60% of the people thought that Ahmadinejad had won that debate. But I should just add one thing, that when it comes to the issues that are of most concern to the United States, issues such as nuclear proliferation and terrorism, the president really doesn't matter. We forget, for example, if you go back to that 2007 National Intelligence Estimate that said that Iran had been working on nuclear warhead design until 2003. Well, who was president until 2003? It wasn't Ahmadinejad. It was Mohammad Khatami. We all got blinded by all of his rhetoric of dialogue of civilizations, and all the while it was the Revolutionary Guard working away on their nuclear warhead design and building the centrifuge plant, which now of such great concern to us.
Now, Michael Rubin, in terms of how Khamenei controls the country, you've got all this appearance of democracy. Can you explain for the listeners why it just is that, an appearance of democracy?
Okay, there's two different ways to control. Number one, when we talk about the supreme leader, he holds ultimate authority. He makes most of the appointments, and he can overrule the parliament and any other body. On a day-to-day basis, the way he runs the government is he has an office and he has around 600 different people who are planted in different parts of the bureaucracy and the military. They're sort of like political commissars. And so instead of acting like an autocrat as Saddam Hussein did in Iraq, what Ayatollah Khamenei does is he rules by veto power in just cutting off bad ideas until people figure out what exactly he wants. The other thing to keep in mind, though, is that right now in the Islamic Republic, you have more members of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, this elite military group, the same group that was smuggling in explosively formed projectiles into Iraq. More members of the Revolutionary Guard are now in parliament than have ever been in government before. There are more governors and deputy governors, ministers and deputy ministers, who are members of the Revolutionary Guard. What my colleague Ali Alfona describes this as is almost like a slow creeping coup d'etat. And so in reality, the politicians have less and less power inside Iran. The clerics actually have a little bit less power, and the Revolutionary Guard is really expanding its talents.
Now, Michael Rubin, in terms of Israel vis-a-vis Iran, what did you make of the president's Cairo speech, by the way, and what did it mean for Israel?
Well, the president is a master of rhetoric, and we've got to give it to the president. He delivers a great speech. What I objected to was actually the content of the speech rather than the style. First of all, I've never been a big fan of moral equivalency, nor have I been the big fan of this idea, which so many Democratic administrations have had, that if you just change the words, problems go away. Madeleine Albright, for example, Secretary of State under Bill Clinton, had talked about how we shouldn't discuss rogue regimes anymore. We should have states of concern, but it didn't make the problems of Iraq, Iran, and North Korea go away. During his Cairo speech, President Obama didn't mention terrorism once, and that's a very dangerous thing. We shouldn't be so afraid of moral clarity and saying this is wrong and this is what the problem is. When it comes to Israel, It almost sounded like he was touching on various talking points which he needed to go through, but he didn't really have the passion, nor did he really explain why it is the United States supports Israel. I don't think he understands, and so many realists of the Walt and Mearsheimer school don't, that Israel, it's not that Israel gains a lot from friendship with the United States. The United States also gains a lot from friendship of Israel. Israel votes with the United States in the UN Security Council and in the UN General Assembly. I'm sorry, not in the Security Council, obviously, in the General Assembly, more than any other country. 90%. The highest Arab country voting with us was Iraq at 30%. And on important votes, Jordan voted with us exactly 0% of the time. Different U.S. presidents since Eisenhower have adopted realism and decided that we should place our national security interests with the Arab states, but slowly Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon all discovered that, frankly, alliances with the Arab states didn't really work well because the Arab states didn't believe in a two-way alliance. So we're going to have some trouble here.
Michael Rubin, in terms of when the president says you can't deny the Holocaust, it happened. On the other hand, the Palestinians have suffered. What did you make of the on the other hand construction?
Well, this is the moral equivalency, which drives me nuts. I mean, it's something which Obama shouldn't have engaged in, but it does give a little bit of an insight into the way he's thinking. I mean, one of these other moral equivalency moments came when he was, in effect, apologizing for all the slights which the Americans have done to the Middle East over the years. Let me give you two examples. Number one, he talked about the coup against Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953. It's incredible. What Obama doesn't seem to realize is that the clerics in Iran, the same people who run the Islamic Republic, also oppose Mossadegh. And so he's basically apologizing to people that opposed this guy and were arguably just as guilty in his overthrow as anyone else. The other thing he does is he, for example, said that he talked about the legacy of colonialism. Well, I'm sorry, the Islamic world went into decline centuries before colonialism, and what it needs is a good dose of accountability that it needs to look within itself to understand why it's fallen so far back.
And free enterprise as well. Michael Rubin from AEI, thank you. I'll be right back. Welcome back, America.